Then I would like to stress one point, and before I turn to the proof of the adiabatic theorem, I think we had some example this morning that there are some misunderstandings between physicists and quantum computing people at the way they are looking at adiabatic theorems. And I think that it is important to stress that they are looking at theorem in slightly different ways to understand where the misunderstanding comes from. So I will say something about that. And then I will give a sketch of the proof. And this is following the lines of the proof which was given by Josiah Braun, Rudisaila, and Jaffe in 1997. Now, unfortunately, there was a small error in the proof of higher order theorems in that initial paper, which was corrected in a paper by Marcus Klein and Rudisaila in 1919. And this is important because that error somewhat has propagated. And so these two papers were not concerned with gap estimates. And you can use the proof to give gap estimates, though some ideas come from Bartlett, from a stock paper from 2004. And then I will say something about applications of these bound strings for Leighton Hamiltonians, and that's basically the needle in a haystack example, which was given by Andrew Charles this morning. So the setting is that we start with a Hilbert space and we consider bound Hamiltonians in that Hilbert space. So again, for the adiabatic theorem, it's not really necessary to have bound operators. And that basically that's what computer scientists are interested in as finite dimensional cases. So it's simply more easy to state results for that. So we consider a family of Hamiltonians and to fix ideas. These depend on the parameter in the interval 0 or s. And I assume the family of Hamiltonians to be smooth, which means k times differentiable, at least twice differentiable. And I suppose that p of s, the projection on the spectral subspace associated finitely many eigenvalues lambda 1 to lambda n, which are separated from the rest of the spectrum by a gap g of s. So I think most of you know the picture which is behind. Which would mean to say that if you draw a spectrum of the Hamiltonian as a function of the parameter, here I have some eigenvalues lambda 1 to lambda n. Now these may do what they wish inside the bound. They can cross. That's without any importance. But they're separated from the rest of the spectrum by some non-vanishing gap g of s. Okay, so P of S is the projection on that side of the spectrum, and Q of S, which is 1 minus P of S, is the projection on the rest of the spectrum. Okay, and I will use P0, Q0 as notations for S equals 0. So the adiabatic theorem, as was said before, is concerned with a time-dependent Schrödinger equation, where the time scale tau enters, or in terms of the small parameter epsilon in the previous talks, that's one over epsilon. And the propagator associated to that equation written down the rescaled time s t over tau satisfies the Schrödinger equation e partial su tau of s equal tau of a over su tau of s. And the theorem says something about the transition amplitude. Now suppose you start in the spectral subspace P of 0, and then evolve, by the time evolution run, and you measure the part which goes through the orthogonal complement Q of S. So that will be represented by that quantity, norm Q of S, and tau of S, P of 0. This can be bounded by a sum of two terms, the first one being a boundary term, where we have norm of h dot over the gap spray which enters, plus a remainder. The remainder is an integral term and can be bounded the way it's shown here. So this was basically the estimate shown this morning. And what is important to notice here is that we have this 1 over gap cubed which enters.
Okay. Can you see what
Well, m was the number of eigenvalues here.
Oh, okay.
So as long as you're only concerned with one eigenvalue or non-degenerate Brownstein, you can set it from n equal to 1. Okay. Okay. Now, if the Hamiltonian is at least 3 times differentiable, this integral remainder can be shown to be, in fact, only 1/tau². So this is what is shown here. And I don't really want you to go through the whole expression because it's quite ugly. It's just to show that you get some complicated things. And when you look here, you have a g cubed, so g over 6. So you have a mixture of different powers of the gas spread. So maybe this is the place to say something about the question this morning, whether you have 1/gas² in this norm phi dot, which was bounded by norm a of h dot through the gap. But what you have, think that physicists and computing applications look at it in a different way, since you can say that the Hamiltonian is made up of 2 pieces of information, one being the projection and one being the spectrum. So if you would say you have your Hamiltonian, one thing is okay. If I look only at the very simple case where I have only 1 eigenvalue, that is, no, not 1 eigenvalue, something like this. 0 times p plus the gap times q. Then you would say that your Hamiltonian, well, you have 2 quantities which enter the Hamiltonian, one being the projection, and the other one being the gap. Now, this holds, of course, for the derivative as well. What enters is information about the differential of the projection and of the gap. Now, I think that physicists, or at least we at the beginning, thought that this was a more natural way to look at it, was to say that, well, the independent quantities which determine which enter our bounds are these two. That was the point of view of George Hagen on this morning, I think. Now, the point of view I think you had was to say, and that is maybe the more natural point of view in adiabatic quantum computing, is to say that the accessible quantity is not p dot, but it's h dot. So in that case, you would take these 2 quantities as basic quantities and use the estimate you already pointed out this morning, which is that p dot is bounded by h dot over the gap. So it's just 2 different ways of looking at the same thing. And this h dot over gap spread is indeed just an upper bound on p dot over gap. So that's really what George Hagedorn wrote down this morning.
But the two, suppose I only was interested in my own little narrow way of the relationship between tau and the gap, those 2 formulas give you the same thing, right? The second one. Because one of them, it says that tau has to be much, 1/tau has to be much less than the gap q in both cases.
Yes. That
the gap into that second. No, the first one says gap tau. The first one says tau times the gap q has to be much bigger than 1. And the second one says it's tau squared times the gap to the set, which is the same condition.
Yeah. Well, in fact, we will see that further example is that what enters here is not 1/minimal gap q, but you have some kind of average. And if you look at the curve, which occurs in that Neil and the Haystack example, it turns out that the integral of 1/gap³ is of the order of 1/minimal gap².
No, I believe that in the generic case of a cross, that's right. But in the for your theorem, I just want to understand this.
Yeah.
For your math theorem, forgetting the special cases,
okay.
Then the time has to be much bigger than 1/gap³. Is that right?
That's right.
That's correct.
Yeah, that's correct.
But of course, in the generic case,
No, because this truth that here, this was pointed out earlier, is that you lose something by estimating it this way, because basically you estimate oscillating integrals by taking the norm inside of the integral, and you lose some information.
Yeah, no, it's there.
So it's not optimal, I guess.
No, it's not optimal. Thank you.
Okay. So now for the 2 different points of view that we have. If you look at that adiabatic theorem, and if I rewrite the estimate for the transition amplitude in some way, well, we have first this boundary term, which was h dot over tau times g², and then we have that integral remainder term, which, if h is sufficiently regular, is some constant divided by tau squared. Now that constant includes dependence on the Hamiltonian, and it includes dependence on the gap. So I think the way usually in quantum mechanics textbooks people look at it is to say that we have one fixed Hamiltonian, and we let the characteristic time go to infinity. Now in this case, of course, you would say the first order term is the more important one. You would drop the rest and say, well, the transition amplitude is the order of norm h dot over tau g squared. And this is what gives rise to that usual wisdom. However, I think that adiabatic quantum computing is interested at a look, at a slightly different look, because they ask that they have, first of all, they have an additional parameter. So the Hamiltonian over there is not fixed anymore, it depends on the size of the problem. So we have a two-parameter problem instead of a one-parameter problem. And the transition amplitude, say from s equal to 0 to s equal 1, depends on these two parameters. And the question is, how should the sequence tau n should be chosen so that the transition amplitude stays bound? And in this case, what happens typically is that this constant from the 1 over tau squared term gets big. So you cannot really neglect it anymore. So it may be that this traditional wisdom that it's 1 over the gap squared stays true, but one has to be careful when saying that it comes from the first order term. That's not that much a question about the wisdom, but about the way to how to justify it mathematically. Okay. Now for the sketch of proof using partial integration. The idea of the proof is to compare real dynamics to idealized dynamics. The idealized dynamics is again described by a propagator, which is tau A, the adiabatic time evolution, which satisfies again a time dependent Schrödinger equation, and the corresponding Hamiltonian is called the adiabatic Hamiltonian, and it's made up of the real Hamiltonian we started with, which is H of S, plus some correcting term which involves the commutator of P dot and P. And that part just ensures that the adiabatic time evolution satisfies exactly what you would like to show that the real time evolution satisfies approximately, which means that it leaves the spectral subspace invariant. So the mathematical expression of this is that U tau A satisfies the intertwined property. If you start in P of 0, then you end up in P of X. So to make a little bit more intuitive what this adiabatic time evolution does, you can look at a two-level system. Say you have two eigenvalue curves, A1 and E2, and one always stays smaller than E2. And you take an orthonormal base of some two-dimensional Lucas space, psi 1 and psi 2, and you choose them such that psi 1 dot and psi 1 are orthogonal, the same for psi 2, so as George Hagedorn for obviously this is always possible, and consider the corresponding Hamiltonian, then one can compute explicitly what the adiabatic time evolution does. And this is that gives you just the phase you would expect. So if you suppose you start in psi 1 of 0 and the eigenstate corresponding to E1, then what the adiabatic time evolution does is that it transforms that the eigenvector is an instantaneous eigenvector. So psi 1 of 0 turns into psi 1 at S and gives you the phase you would expect from H, which is E2 minus I tau and the integral of E1. Okay. Now we want to compare the real time dynamics to the adiabatic time dynamics. And to do this, one uses this tool from scattering theory, which is the wave operator. So in this here it's defined as U tau A star times U tau. And what we expect that is that this operator is close to unity if tau is big. Mm-hmm. Moreover, the transition amplitude you want to estimate in the adiabatic theorem is linked to the off-diagonal blocks of this wave operator. Because using cleverly the intertwining property, you can show that the transition amplitude Q of S U tau of S P0 is equal to the off-diagonal block Q0 times the wave operator times P0. Okay. Now, that's right. If you differentiate the wave operator, what you end up is a differential equation you can put into the form of a Volterra equation. So the wave operator satisfies the Volterra equation with where the current which shows up includes the commutator, P dot P, flanked by the adiabatic time evolution on the left and the right hand side. Again, it is useful to look at a two-dimensional example of a two-level system to see a little bit what this kernel looks like. If you look at a two-level system, and you write down the kernel on the basis determined by the initial eigenstates, you have just a 2x2 matrix. And that 2x2 matrix, so it's anti-symmetric, it is zero on the diagonal, and the off-diagonal elements have an oscillating part e to the I tau integral of the gap times something which is related to that t dot, and which in this case does the scalar product of psi 2 and the derivative of psi 1. So this shows that this Volterra equation gives rise to oscillating integrals. And there is a simple mechanism to show that it's small. That's just to use integration by parts. And this is what one does. So we can start by writing down the integration by parts just for functions. But suppose that I have some function capital G, which is basically the primitive of the gap, with derivative small g, which is different from zero. If I write down partial integration, where I have e to the I tau g times alpha, so that came from the kernel we had before, times some function f, which would be the function you apply the integral operator to, and you integrate by parts, you end up with something which has three terms. So one boundary term, and then just two remaining integral terms. And you gain a 1 over tau by doing this partial integration. Now, this is basically what you do, but you need an operator version of this. So an operator version of this, we have need somewhat an analog of the transformation which transforms this function alpha into a function alpha over g. And that analog is given by, well, the Wittwedel transformation. So to define the Wittwedel operator, we need a contour which circles just the eigenvalues we have over there. So suppose we have the real axis. Here I have the eigenvalues lambda j on which p project, which live in some interval. This is bounded away from the rest of the spectrum. So I can find a contour which we call gamma of s, which encircles that part of the spectrum.
Is the complex energy plane?
What's complex here?
Oh, I'm sorry. This is the eigenvalues.
It's the complex energy
plane. Okay, I'm sorry.
No, I just did a little
so
bit.
So it's a
complex.
Oh, just said it's complex.
It's resolved.
Oh,
yeah,
it's resolved. So.
Yeah.
And it's isolated.
So you know that we define this integral.
Okay. So you're just looking at z. That's the complex. You're looking where the poles of h minus z inverse are as a function of z.
Yeah.
Okay.
So what is classical is that you can represent the projection corresponding to that part of the spectrum by an integral over that contour by saying that this is 1 minus 1 over 2 pi I. And then do the contour integral of the resolvent. So basically, the definition is in this thing. And you start with some operator x of s. You put the resolvent on the left-hand side and the right-hand side in the complex energy plane and integrate over this contour. So just because this is where the gap assumption enters, because I need the gap in order to have some contour which does not cross the spectrum. Okay. Now, this operator is basically, this x tilde would be some analog of x divided by the gap. To make that more explicit, I should maybe state what this looks like in our case. So George Hagedorn already introduced that reduced result of this morning. If you restrict, say you start with an eigenvalue lambda j, h minus lambda j is singular. However, you can restrict that to q. With this, I mean the range of q. So this operator restricted to the range of q is non-singular. So you can take the inverse set the operator to be zero on the range of P. So this I would denote that as the reduced resolvent corresponding to the eigenvalue lambda j. Now what this trivial operation does that one can compute explicitly is that x tilde is equal to a sum over j running from 1 to m, so that was the number of eigenvalues, and you adjoin the reduced resolvent on the left side, have the operator x in the middle, and the corresponding projection on the eigenspace to lambda j on the right-hand side, then you have the whole thing, the adjoint of it. So, and this is somewhere where this Erhard, the reduced resolvent has a norm which is of the order 1 of the gap. So basically this x tilde will have a norm which will be the norm of x divided by the gap. And in some sense, so you have the number of eigenvalues which enters here because when you estimate everything, you have this n which enters. And the idea just is to estimate this explicitly. This is what is from Dan Reichert. However, he did it just by using a clever choice of the contour, which is possible only when you have what the simple eigenvalue. So you need this expression if you jump to the case where you have several eigenvalues. Now, with the help of this expression, it's possible to do an integration by parts just for operators. So I don't write down the general case, I just write down what it does for the wave operator. Now remember, we have that Volterra equation for the wave operator with an identity part. Now I'm interested only in the off diagonal part, so the identity, of course, disappears if I multiply with Q0 on the left side and Q0 on the right side. And I have only that integral, which looks this way, like you have p dot, the derivative, and you have the adiabatic time evolution adjoint on the left and the right side with projection corresponding to different eigenspaces. So this would be a view then, the analog of this would be to say that the p dot, that's the alpha of the first formula, and the q0 u tau a star and the u tau a p0 on the other side gives you together the e to the I tau g in the first formula, the integration by part. And the wave operator, if you compare it to the partial integration in the first line, plus the f. Now you can do a partial integration for that and end up with three terms, just in perfect homology to the first line. You end up with a term, in the first line you have f dot. In this case, it's the derivative of the wave operator. And by the Volterra equation, you can again write down that you have an expression for the derivative of the wave operator, which is important because now we want just to bound all this. And these two equations together show that the transition amplitude of the order is of the order of 1 over tau. Okay. Now, from this to explicit gap estimates, it's only a short way. What you have to do, yeah?
Can I ask this? But you do not claim that this derivation is new, do you?
No.
That's
no,
it's 20 not years old.
Yeah, oh, 20 years old, and it's yeah, that was what I was writing at the beginning, that basically is the proof by Hervé Zahle that that partial integration idea is very old, as George Heidegger pointed out this morning. It's just that later on, so I think Van Reichert was the first to use this as a basis for having explicit gap estimates.
I just know it in Kevin's book.
Yeah, and it's there as well.
Is that the first? Or?
No, Tauber was not the first. No.
I'm not Tauber, Thielen.
Oh,
Thielen.
Okay. In Kevin's book, it is not done in this way. So I think what one can say with regard to the history, in our work with Yossi and Braun and Jochle, we used this adiabatic solution, which contains part of Kato. and this other thing. And I think this was the first place where this method was used.
Yeah, no, it's not. Mm. Okay, so we have that forming graph where the integration by parts was carried out. In order to have explicit gap estimates, all we need to do is to estimate all the operators. So I won't do this explicitly, but the idea is basically that you have expressions of this type, and that expressions of this type are basically the norm of the original operator divided by the gap. And using this, you end up with estimates of all these quantities. And what enters here, and that's why, again, this question of how p dot and h dot is related, is that in this notation, p dot is nothing else but, so you have that expression where p is expressed as an integral involving the resolvent. So if you differentiate this, you have an h dot in the middle and two resolved at the end. So what we have is that p dot is h dot twiddle. So p dot is h, as in, it's h dot by the gap. And you have to carry out these estimates just for the higher order terms which appeared, and by plugging all these into, you end up with the estimates we have. Okay. Now, there was this 1 over g cubed appearing, and there was an initial idea that you could get better estimates by iterating the integration by parts concerning the gap dependence. And that's the point where some initial mistake in the paper in 1997 propagated, and that is that you have to be careful when you iterate the integration by parts. Because, so here you have this boundary term, okay, you leave it as it is, and you have these two integrals. Now these two integrals, it's quite straightforward to think that you just have to iterate the integration by parts. However, if you do so naively in the second integral, you would end up with higher order differentials of the wave operator. And if you do this, because already the derivative of the wave operator involves the adiabatic time evolution, you end up with powers of tau, because you have to differentiate the adiabatic time evolution. That was defined in terms of a Schrödinger equation involving tau times the Hamiltonian. And you end up with powers of tau, so you gain powers of tau by doing the partial integration, but you lose some because you have to differentiate omega tau. So what you have to do instead to make the procedure correct is that if you insert the expression you have for omega dot in there, well, you notice that you have in the integral, again, the off-diagonal block q0 omega tau p0, you have just at the beginning of the line. So what you can do is that you insert recursively this expression in the second integral. But the price you pay, of course, is that you have multiple integrals, and all expressions that just get not very nice. That was the second part of the theorem I've read on the blackboard. And it's not really clear that this improves the gap dependence. Okay, so the question somewhat remains, what about the traditional criterion that it's h dot over the gap squared? And more precisely, what does the integration by part method say about this? So I think that in general, I'm not able to make any statement about this. However, it might be useful to look again at the example, which was already described this morning. So I think I can go through the definition of that example quite fast. So you start with a Hilbert space H equal to C2 10 centered M times. And consider Hamiltonian, which is an interpolation between an initial Hamiltonian and a final Hamiltonian, defined both as 1 minus some projection. The initial Hamiltonian being the projection on the superposition of all states, which is 1 minus 3, 0 half, 0 half. And the final Hamiltonian being 1 minus the projection on the element you look for. So this Hamiltonian basically is effectively the problem you have is basically a two-level problem, because you have a two-level. The only thing which is interesting, what happens is in the subspace generated by the zero hat and u, and you can compute everything explicitly, among others, the gap function. So the gap function was plotted on, was plotted this morning, and it's just something going like this and being minimal at s equal 1/2. And the minimal gap is 2 to the minus n. So this being explicitly known, and moreover, h dot in this context really doesn't count because it's just rule of 1. You can plug in this function, and this function has a peculiar property that in general, just because the region where the gap is small is very small, you gain something by not bounding crudely the integral by the worst case of the integral, but just by looking really at the integrals, and you gain a power. So the integral of 1 over g cubed is basically 1 over the minimum gap squared, which means that the bound, at least for that example, still confirms the wisdom that it's 1 over, that time is 1 over gap squared. However, one thing is, one can look at it, one has to be aware of here, is that if you would look just at the expression of the transition amplitude in 1, the gap at the boundaries is over 1. So this shows that what makes the transition amplitude big, if you were to think only of the final transition amplitude and not of the transition amplitude somewhere in between, is not that boundary term, which is usually used to justify the 1 over gap squared dependence of the time, but it's really that integral term. So that's linked to that question that it's a slightly different look at theorem that usual quantum physicists have and adiabatic computing application imply. Then there was this idea to adapt the interpolation, so among others, Pepin and Pandemos and Vasirani, which was mentioned this morning, which is to say that, okay, you interpolate, you still move in the space of Hamiltonians on the straight line between h0 and h1, but the speed with which you travel through that line is adapted to the gap, which means in this case that m dot is taken to be proportional to some power of the gap. And if you choose that power suitably, which means in this case between 1 and 2, and again, use the bounds you have. We have. You end up with a transition amplitude, which is 1 over the time times the minimal gap. So that gives you then the quadratic speed up for searching the knot structure, which we already mentioned this morning. Okay. So now there's one thing which occurred to me a little bit later, is that this is reminiscent of a way to take it on treated Landau-Zener transition in 1991, because he already pointed out that typically, Landau-Zener transitions are concerned with gap functions, which are something like this. A squared, p squared, plus some c squared, I think it was. So this is really what we have here if we replace p squared by s minus 1/2 squared. So this is really the typical situation in some sense. So maybe one can use this to show that I mean, you could wonder whether simply our estimates are too bad or not the right method, but I think that then George Hagedorn's result would give that it's really 1 over gap squared, because this is just the usual avoided crossing situation. And moreover, he explicitly considered a Hamiltonian where you have these two parameters showing up. What I didn't write on the slides, that's okay. Considers, please correct me if I do anything wrong in recording your work. So he considers the time-dependent Schrödinger equation, where he has this characteristic time tau, which is 1 over epsilon. And at the same time, he has a Hamiltonian, which does not depend on one parameter, which is defined, but additionally on another small parameter. And this other small parameter, he writes down h of t delta. This delta is related to the minimum gap. So he would consider a situation where the spectrum of the Hamiltonian h of t delta, if I plot the spectrum as a function of t, has a minimal gap, which is delta. So looking at this time dependent Schrödinger equation, he takes the situation where the gap is explicitly dependent on the time, the relation being that the gap is 1 over the 1 over square root of time. The gap is 1 over square root of, I mean, okay, you see it there, sorry. And I think this is really related to that picture. And what I think is interesting in that context, too, is to say that the work that Buskay counted on this morning is that they used other way of evaluating the transition amplitudes is that they use the Landesing formula. So in some sense, maybe this is the typical situation, or in any way, this really raises the question, how can I estimate it better? I don't know if integration at parts really is optimal.
So there, the inverse notation, epsilon is 1 over,
well, 1 over tau.
1 over tau. So what is T? That's just a different.
Oh, T is what we have called S. Yeah, that's. Yeah. Okay, and this is the minimal gap, which Andrew is suffering. So the conclusion of that part is to say that one has to be aware when going through physical literature that the adiabatic quantum computers setting is slightly different. And okay, there is still this fault theorem that the transition amplitude is of the order h dot over tau gap squared. I'm not saying that this intuition is wrong, but still might be wrong. However, okay, with the fact that it's the integral remainder which counts in most cases among the boundary terms. However, if you want to justify that criterion rigorously using integration by parts, at least I'm not saying anything about different techniques, as you have to have a closer look at the gap function. And I mean, one has to be really careful about that. Okay, so.
So if you look at your general theorem, mm-hmm. it has a 1 over the gap Q.
Yeah.
But when you look at the cross, you see 1 over the gap squared. Mm-hmm. So you feel like 1 over the gap squared might be always the answer. So wouldn't mm-hmm. another way to approach this be to find an example where it really was 1 over the gap Q? Yeah. Then you would just know it was right.
I broke the question. It's going like 1 over G squared multiplied by a log 1.
You can't. Are you saying you
can find examples where you have 1 over Q?
Not this smooth function.
Yeah.
With the smooth, you think there's you have a smooth function example? With the
no, not smooth.
Not smooth. It's smooth function. So that's what I'm going to show.
But let me ask you then. Let me just restrict my question. If you just had smooth functions. You think you can't do 1 over the gap cubed? You say you can't.
No, you can do better.
So you're saying there is no smooth function example where it goes like 1 over the gap.
Well, if the function is, it depends what you call smooth.
Wow. Smooth.
Depends how fast the unit is.
Oh, I see.
Also, I mean, so if it behaves like n factorial square in hundreds,
then you could get 1 over the gap.
Five half.
I see. Okay, that's interesting. We good. Thanks. We have our next talk at 4 o'clock by Alexander Kroger. Then we have a 45-minute discussion section. Could I